o'clock. Pauline and Ron have just got back from a long weekend in Stratford-upon-Avon. I asked Ron what Shakespeare they had seen, but he looked at me blankly. So I think they spent the whole weekend in the pub. Ibrahim looks a bit lost without Ron. I know he is very happy for him, but perhaps I need to keep an eye on him. We often walk Alan together, and he natters away quite happily, but even so. And talking of walking dogs, I do often bump into Mervyn and Rosie. Mervyn is so handsome. I have to stop my tail from wagging when I'm around him. He doesn't say much, but sometimes that can be a relief, can't it? With some men, you spend most of your time just nodding in agreement. I take Mervyn a casserole every now and again, always enough for two, just to see if he takes the hint. But he just says, "Thank you." "That'll last me 2 days." But the way he says it in that deep, commanding voice, well, it's worth it just for that. He hasn't yet shown any real sign of interest, though the other day he did bring round his copy of The Times and said, "There's an article in there about Margaret Atwood, about how she writes her books. Thought you might be interested." That must be the longest sentence he's ever said to me, so you never know. I read the article, so we will have something to talk about next time I see him. Christmas is just around the corner, and I'm hoping Joanna and Scott might come down. I haven't really asked what everyone is doing. I wonder if Ron will be with Pauline. Perhaps they'd like to come round here. And Ibrahim, without question. I wonder what Victor is doing for Christmas. I will ask him tomorrow, as we have all been invited for lunch at his. This time, I will be bringing my swimming costume. I don't care how cold it is. My crypto account, which was somewhere over £65,000 at one point, is now worth £800. I emailed Henrik and he replied saying, "Joyce, you must believe." Believe what? I don't know. But whatever you might say about cryptocurrency, it's more fun than premium bonds. Such a lot has happened this year. And my favourite thing of all has just bounded into the room looking for trouble. Alan thinks it is time for bed, and as so often, he is quite right. Chapter 89. Greed. That was the thing. The fatal flaw. Why wasn't he happy with what he had? Actually, it was greed and being too clever. The two fatal flaws. Sitting here in Belmarsh, when he should be on a Spanish terrace with a cold beer and a hot typewriter. A cold beer and a hot typewriter. Andrew Everton writes that down in his notebook. The new book, Guilty or Not Guilty, is going to be his best yet, just as soon as they let him use a computer. Perhaps after he's been convicted, they'll let him use one. How many books will he have to sell to pay back £10 million under the Proceeds of Crime Act? A lot, that's his guess. The VAT scheme, so simple, so victimless, how had it gone so wrong? The plot for a book turned into a real-life crime. He should have left it as a book. Trusted his writing. Grisham-esque, someone had called it. He forgets who. He should never have sent the bullet to Bethany, either. He had hoped it might scare her off. Never should have emailed asking to meet her. He should have stayed in the shadows. Life was not a book. So many bodies, and he had only murdered one of them. He told Jack and Heather he had murdered Bethany Shaw. That was a masterstroke. Blackmailed them with a corpse that was never there. The Coast Guards had told him that if the body hadn't washed up within a week, it was probably not going to be washed up at all. And that's what gave him the idea, such a clever idea. too clever in the end. It was so unfair. You shouldn't be penalized for being too clever. And he told the guy with the pebbly glasses that he'd killed Bethany too, because that's what he thought the guy wanted to hear. That's how he thought he was going to get his money. Greed and being too clever. Look where it gets you. Who had killed Bethany Waits? Andrew Everton has no idea. It wasn't him, and he knows it wasn't Jack Mason, or his little blackmail scheme wouldn't have worked. And where did all that money end up? He has no idea about that either. Who was the guy in the glasses? Was Elizabeth Best everything she seemed? His whole life had begun to unravel after he'd first met her. So many questions and so few answers. As he looks at the four walls of his cell, segregated from fellow prisoners, locked up for 24 hours a day for his own safety and doing his business in a metal bucket bolted to a wall, it occurs to Andrew Everton that for someone so clever, there seem to be an awful lot of things he doesn't know. There is some good news, and you should always focus on the good news. There was no material evidence to link him to Bethany's or Heather's death. His solicitor would make short work of the eyewitness at Darwell Prison. Maybe he would beat the murder charges. The public was baying for his blood, but the public was always baying for something. They would move on soon enough. Mike Waghorn had been right about that. Perhaps he would only be convicted of the fraud. And what would he serve? Maybe he'd do 5 years of a 10-year sentence, write a series of best-selling books where a prisoner solves crimes from inside his cell, call it Hard Cell or The Wingman. Yes, focus on the good things. Ironic that in the one murder he actually had committed, it looked like he wasn't even going to be a suspect. The moment Jack Mason started talking, Andrew had had to kill him. No choice. Make it look like a simple suicide. Jack knew it the second he opened the door. Death comes knocking. Andrew Everton writes that down in his notebook too, under good titles. If he can beat these murder raps, 5 years will just fly by. Chapter 90. Chris is celebrating solving the case in the way that all hard-bitten cops have done throughout the ages. He is drinking blueberry kombucha and dipping celery sticks into organic hummus as he watches the darts. He is thinking that murdering people must have been so much easier before the era of DNA evidence. You almost had to feel sorry for homicidal maniacs these days. If you kill somebody, particularly at close range with a gun, then, and there's no nice way of putting it, their DNA will spatter all over you, all over your hands and your clothes, and that DNA is then transferred to anything you might touch. At the Kent Police Awards, Patrice had wondered who Chris could arrest next to get another commendation, to get another night of black tie and free Prosecco next year, another cute shiny badge in another cute velvet pouch. Well, after the message he has just received, Chris knows he will definitely be invited back next year, and it is all thanks to Patrice. The start of the whole thing was this. The gun was just so small. It had been niggling at Chris. For a man with access to so many guns, legal and illegal, why would Jack Mason have shot himself with a gun small enough to be slipped into someone's pocket? The answer, as so often, was very simple. It was because the gun had been slipped into someone's pocket. When Andrew Everton had stolen it from the dig in Heather Garbutt's garden, he had chosen the smallest gun possible, simply because he was going to have to walk out past any number of police officers without a soul spotting it. He couldn't have hidden an AK-47, even though they had actually found two of them. Chris had asked for more tests on the gun, and those tests proved the gun had been buried alongside four others uncovered on the dig. Same fibres from the cloth they were wrapped in, same acids from the soil. The ammunition, too. So Andrew Everton had seen the gun, stolen it, and had then used Jack Mason's own gun to shoot him. It was good evidence, that's for sure. But it was not perfect. No one saw Andrew Everton pocket the gun. Anyone at the dig might have stolen it. Jack Mason himself might have dug it up weeks previously, planning his suicide. Jack might have thought, I know what I'll do. I'll dig up a tiny gun I buried 10 years ago. In court, a decent lawyer would soon throw doubt on the gun, and Andrew Everton will have a decent lawyer. But it was good enough evidence for Chris to know that Andrew Everton had killed Jack Mason. He just needed to prove it. He and Donna had talked it through. They didn't want Everton taking the stand and wriggling out of a murder charge on a technicality. Chris needed to find some evidence that placed Everton directly at the scene of Jack Mason's murder and at the moment it was happening, some DNA. But where to find it? It was Patrice who had the idea in the end. She made the suggestion about exactly where the DNA might be found. Chris was dubious, more than anything, it would just be too ironic. But after a few more prompts, he had contacted the forensic lab, and today the results had come back. She was right. He has just texted her at a parent's evening to let her know. Everton would have cleaned himself thoroughly, of course. The blood and the gore and the DNA of Jack Mason they contained should have been long gone. But Andrew Everton had been sloppy. Or, knowing the man a little now, Chris thought it more likely he had been cocky. Perhaps he hadn't destroyed his clothes until the day after the murder. The day he was all laughs and smiles sitting next to Chris and Patrice at the award ceremony. Perhaps he recontaminated himself while he was disposing of them. Whatever the reason, it is going to be very hard for Andrew Everton to explain where traces of Jack Mason's DNA have just been found. On the cute, shiny badge and the cute velvet pouch Andrew Everton had handed to Chris at the Kent Police Awards. Chris pops another celebratory celery stick into his mouth. Get out of that one. Chapter 91. There is something Bogdan isn't telling her. Elizabeth can see that. It's not about Donna. Three cheers for the two of them and all that, but it's definitely something. She has left him with Stephen again today, regardless. They will discuss it when she gets home.
It has been an adventure, says Victor. I am grateful for that. I have been shot, buried, and brought back to life, and I've played a lot of snooker.
Welcome to the Thursday Murder Club, says Elizabeth. They are sitting on Victor's terrace, laptop open and gin and tonic poured. London spreads out before them in a vast panorama of greens and blues and greys, the buses like red blood cells. It all looks so genteel from up here, but they both well know the secrets that lie beneath the roofs of London. The money, the murder, the evil the people do, it was simply their stock and trade. Where you saw a cosy family chimney, they saw a corpse being burnt. Such is the way of things after nearly 60 years in the business. It is cold, but the cold helps them both think. Andrew Everton is behind bars, awaiting trial. Jack Mason and Heather Garbutt are in the ground. Henrik is back in Staffordshire, but has started sending Victor cat videos from the internet. That feels a lot like a ceasefire to Elizabeth. She is pleased, now that she has found Victor again. she would rather not lose him. But Victor and she were agreed. It was a job half done. Victor had made Andrew Everton confess. Victor made everyone confess sooner or later, but it didn't feel right to either of them. They had discussed it at length. Had they uncovered the full story? Had they got the wrong man? How is Stephen? Asks Victor. Another time, says Elizabeth. Henrik has kept up the search, but everywhere he looked, the money had simply disappeared. They had cleared up Karen Whitehead and Michael Gullis. They had never got close to Robert Brown, MSc. Perhaps there was some genius who could crack that one in time, but Elizabeth and Victor have both stopped trying. Henrik has uncovered one lead, though. It was another early payment, this time for £100,000. Victor and Elizabeth scan the file in front of them. Henrik has tracked the payment as far as the British Virgin Islands, where it was further broken down into four separate payments. One of the payments found its way to the Cayman Islands, but that path has gone cold. One headed to Panama and one to Liechtenstein and into the endless corridors of banking secrecy. But the fourth payment was the interesting one, to the International Bank of Dubai. It seems out of place. Why pay money to Dubai? Says Elizabeth. Surely there are plenty of places much safer, much darker. Access, perhaps, says Victor. Was this a little bit of spending money for someone? Elizabeth thinks she might take some time investigating the Dubai connection. She knows people there. £10 million has gone missing somewhere, but sometimes £100,000 is all you need to catch someone, and Elizabeth would love to catch whoever killed Bethany Waits. But perhaps she is a fool. Perhaps she is missing something obvious. It certainly feels that way. In her bones, she knows it's not quite right. Are her powers waning? She is getting old. She uses a foot spa these days. She's even going to get Joyce one for Christmas. Is it time to quit all this nonsense, all this running around after shadows? Victor shivers in the cold. Elizabeth adjusts his blanket. Thank you, says Victor. Your country is so cold. So is yours, says Elizabeth, and Victor concedes the point. Time to quit all this nonsense? Elizabeth laughs to herself. What is there in life other than nonsense? Perhaps, says Elizabeth, a little winter sunshine would do us some good. Perhaps, agrees Victor. Any suggestions? I hear Dubai is very temperate this time of year. I hear that too, says Victor. And they say the shopping is very good. There are even art galleries. Well, we could have a poke around the art galleries, couldn't we? Spot of shopping, says Victor. Soak up the sun. Wouldn't do any harm, would it? Says Elizabeth. She may be old, but she knows she will find something there, the missing piece. You know, says Victor, I remember being at the bottom of that hole, having all that earth shoveled over me. I remember looking up at everybody and wondering if this might be the life for me. Cooper's Chase, the tea and the cake and the birds and the dogs and the friends, if it might be where I belong. You will understand that. Only too well, says Elizabeth. I was lonely, says Victor. You fixed that for me. You and your friends. My friends. They are quite something, aren't they? They are quite something, agrees Elizabeth. Did I tell you I'm going to get a snooker table? Ron spoke of little else in the car up here, says Elizabeth. I had to feign sleep.
It's the people in the end, isn't it? Says Victor. It's always the people. You can move halfway around the world to find your perfect life, move to Australia if you like, but it always comes down to the people you meet.
Elizabeth looks over to the swimming pool, suspended in the sky. There is Joyce, swimming laps, her head above water, so as not to get her hair wet. The boys, Ron and Ibrahim, are by the side of the pool wearing overcoats on day beds. Ibrahim is struggling to read the Financial Times in the wind. Ron is trying to work out how the lid goes back on his coffee cup. It is far too cold to swim, but Joyce would not be dissuaded. Elizabeth had told her not to be so silly and that the pool would still be here in the summer.
Ah, but we may not be,
Joyce had replied, and she was right. It was best to grab everything while you could. Who knows when your final swim might come, your final walk, your final kiss. Elizabeth has an idea what secret Bogdan is keeping from her. So be it. Joyce sees Elizabeth looking and gives her a wave. Elizabeth waves back.
You keep swimming, Joyce. You keep swimming, my beautiful friend. You keep your head above the water for as long as you can.
Well, everyone, you just finished the book. I am sure you enjoyed it. It's Steph McGovern here, because I've managed to grab Richard for a bit of a chat about the book.
Hello, Steph. How are
Richard,
you?
Richard, yeah. How are you? Yeah, I'm brilliant. How are you?
Yeah, I'm not bad. I mean, as you say, people have literally just finished. I always do that thing of, you know, you always, sometimes I think, oh, there's still a whole chapter to go. And you go, oh, no, it's the audio discussion between Steph and Richard. But, yeah, people have literally just heard the end of it. So we'll give them 5 seconds just to compose themselves.
Yeah.
But we're going to have a nice little chat about the books and about audio and all sorts of things. So hopefully people can just relax, take a few deep breaths, and we'll just have a natter, shall we?
Yeah, let's do that. But you're right, maybe we should give them a moment first.
Let's give them 3 seconds.
Okay.
Two, three. Okay, let's get into it.
So, Richard, the bullet that missed, the third now in the series of the Thursday Murder Club. How does it feel that you've now got 3 under your belt?
I mean, it does seem crazy because it's, you know, the one thing I always say about books is they're really, really hard to write. And they're like such a huge undertaking. And, you know, I still feel like I only just finished the first one. And to write 3, you think that's almost a body of work, Steph.
Isn't it?
It's almost like a canon,
yeah.
And I'm writing the fourth one at the moment. But it's extraordinary in life, that thing of, you know, if you write 1,000 words a day, you know, sooner or later you've got 3 books, you know, and there's 3 books in the bookshops and on the shelves, which seems absolutely insane to me.
Yeah.
What I always think, thank you so much to everyone who just listened, and I hope you enjoyed it. But that idea that it takes me a year to write and you can probably finish it in 3 or 4 days and, you know, you move straight along and they're just going, come on, mate, where's the next one? And you think,
yeah.
Oh, the next one will be along in a year. It's honestly, it takes me a long time. But no,
yeah.
Having 3 books is, it's great. And you can sort of really get into the characters and you can build things up and, you know, it feels like a whole world now.
Yeah, and I really want to talk about the characters because they're brilliant. But first of all, take me back to the beginning then. What made you want to start murdering people? Like, fictionally,
well,
of course.
Listen, we all want to, don't we? I mean, if we're honest with ourselves. I mean, that's the British way, isn't it? To be as polite as possible to people, but then think, oh, do you know what? If I could get you alone in a belfry with an ice pick, there'd be trouble. I love crime fiction, you know, and when I make telly, I try and make telly I would watch. And when I write, obviously, I'd try and write a book that I haven't read before. You know, I try and write a book that if I was walking to a bookshop, I'd go, oh, I like the sound of that. So I was always, it's always going to be crime fiction. And then as soon as I had this idea, you know, the four of them, these four troublemakers, that sort of TV bit of my brain, the little alarm goes off where you go, oh, this is quite good. This feels like you could sort of explore all the things you want to explore about Britain And at the same time, you have these sort of overlooked detectives who people are going to root for. And you know it can be funny, and you know there's places where it's going to be sad. And yeah, as soon as I had the idea of the four detectives, I sort of felt, it feels like if I get it right, which is a tough thing to do, then this will run and run. And to still be doing it now is amazing.
Yeah, well, you definitely got it right. You know, they're all bestsellers, aren't they? So you say you had this idea of the four detectives. Where did that come from then?
Well, my mum lives in a retirement community down in Sussex, which is has many similarities to Cooper's Chase. It is less murderous, as far as I know, actually. it's possible that someone there is bumping off people. But listen, I have no evidence that anyone's been killed there or investigating those crimes. But yeah, firstly, that location and the beauty and the beauty of that location, and, you know, the quintessential birds singing, and, you know, I think I said in the first book, the sound of birds singing and Amazon delivery trucks going over the cattle grid. And so that felt quite Agatha Christie-esque every time I would go there. You know, it had just had that sort of feel to it. And then I just speaking to people in their 70s and 80s and just seeing what we were losing and what was being wasted, the stories and the wisdom and the experiences that were sort of just being shut away behind, you know, in this community. And I thought, well, that's a world, you know, that's a world I would like to unleash. You know, I'd like to take those experiences and that wisdom and unleash it upon the modern world and show what they could do. And that, I think people who are older enjoy reading them because it's, hopefully, there's nothing patronising in there. But I think younger people are loving reading them because they think, oh, I'd love to end up like that. I'd love to end up in that community, solving murders with my friends and drinking at lunchtime. You know, solving murders and drinking at lunchtime seem to be the main takeaways that people have from where these people live. And yeah, that's really similar to where my mum lives.
Yeah, and it's really interesting you say that, because it's about, the characters are so great because there's so much depth to them because of the life they've lived. Mm. And you're right, we essentially write people off quite often, don't we, when they're older and go, oh, you know, we become a bit patronising sometimes. And
blame them for all the ills of the world. And the lovely thing about these retirement communities as well is, because, listen, everyone loves a gang. That's the key thing with the Thursday Murder Club stories, is they're a gang. And listen, if they met at a golf club or the yacht club, then they're all going to be the same people.
Yeah.
Whereas you meet in that community and you get people from very, very different backgrounds. And that's the way a gang works. If you've got two working class characters and two middle class characters, you know it's going to be fun. You know, yeah. You know they're going to approach things differently. You know they're going to have arguments, but you know they're going to have strengths which help each other. So just the idea of unlikely bedfellows, people being thrown together, like, you know, like a first term at uni, really, but no one has any work to do.
God, it just sounds idyllic, doesn't it? I love it. Mm. So when you're coming up with these characters then, and you're obviously basing it on going to see your mum and all the people you've seen there, do you now have a million ideas in your head for things they're going to do? Or are you worried that, you know, you say you're writing number four now, that you're going to run out of stuff?
I don't think I'll run out of stuff, you know, because, as you say, the characters drive me through and they've got, you know, a life of their own, and I love the things that are happening in their personal lives. And then you just have to throw a murder into the mix. And that, to me, is lovely. I mean, that's to anyone who's sitting at home writing at the moment. That's the fun bit, is seeing who gets murdered and why. And then how do I hide that fact from my detectives? And then how do I hide that fact from my readers? So I think that their internal lives, you know, that there's enough that will keep me writing them forever because I love them. And in terms of, can I keep thinking of murders? I mean, I don't know what it says about me, but yes, I can.
Yeah.
I can non-stop think about people who might be killed and why they might be killed and how they might be killed. But yeah, it's fascinating because literally as I speak to you now, no spoilers. It's the hottest day of the year, Steph. People don't know that. If you remember back to July, that's when we're talking. But I'm literally just starting writing number four, and I know the world that it's in. Okay, so I know roughly where I want to be. I know there's something I want to explore, but I have no idea who's going to get murdered, and I have no idea how they're going to get murdered, and I have no idea what the twist is going to be. But I can feel in my bones already that it's going to be, I can feel the fun of it. I can feel that it's a good world for me. And it's just that idea of, oh, I could, I'm inventing them, so I could kill any of them. And it's this bit is fun. Then there'll be 6 months of slog, and then the last 3 months of fun as well. When you're honing it to a bullet point.
Yeah. Do you map it out then? Because it sounds like you're kind of figuring it out as you go, rather than going, right, I'm going to map out exactly who's done what and where and when, and then I'm going to write it.
I don't map it out at all, really. I don't have any of those, you know, charts on the wall or anything. And I sort of think I don't have a great attention span, is the truth. And I think if I'd mapped it out already and then I was just filling in the gaps, I think I might get bored. So I've always got a direction of travel. You know, I know where I'm headed, and I always try and know what my next five scenes are going to be. But the joy of it is being taken by surprise. And sometimes it's by, and you know, you bring a character in just for one line, and then you think, oh, that's an interesting character, and you take things in a different direction. Bogdan, originally, in the very first book, he was only supposed to be in one scene. He was just sort of there because he was a builder for one of the murder victims. But he just said a couple of things, and I thought, oh, I want to hang out with you a little bit more. Yeah. And so my process is, I sort of know where I'm headed. I know the world I'm in, but halfway through writing a scene, there'll be a line of dialogue or a character, and I just think, oh, this is new, this is interesting, and I go in that direction. And I think that if I'm constantly taking myself by surprise, then hopefully I'm taking the reader by surprise as well, because the readers have got less time to work out what you're doing than you do.
So do you write chronologically then? Because what I like as well is that the mix between which characters talk and which characters head you're in. Do you do that in order, or do you skip chapters or whatever?
I pretty much do it in order, that's the idea. And then obviously at the end you do move things around and stuff gets changed, but I try and write it in order. If I know the ending, like the first two books, I knew I had sort of a big set piece ending, and I did sort of write that about two thirds of the way through, just to give myself, just so then I just had to fill in the little gap in the middle. I like to write chronologically, and as you say, I love having sort of six or seven main characters, all of whom can carry chapters by themselves, because as soon as I finish one chapter, I know what the next chapter is, and I think, oh, who would be best to tell this one? And then suddenly you're in Ron's head, or, you know, you're in the villain's head, or sometimes, you know, or you're in Donna's head. And it's lovely to have all those different characters, all of whom think differently, and all of whom give you a different perspective. And again, that's my concentration span. You know, I like short chapters, and I like to move somewhere different straight after I've been somewhere. And, you know, that's people seem to like reading that as well, or listening to it.
Yeah, oh God, yeah. Do you have a favourite character? I was trying to think whether I do, and I was like, yeah, definitely Elizabeth. And I thought, oh, I really like Joyce, though. Do you have a favourite?
Yeah, listen, I have a sneaking affection for Ron. Is the truth. No, I really love all of them. And, you know, I love the ancillary characters. I mean, I love Bogdan. I could write him all day long. No, I have different favourites on different days, which I think is good. And the four of them, the more I think about it, I think a four very distinct quarters of my brain. And so actually they all slightly feel part of me in very different ways. I love writing Joyce. If ever I'm stuck, if ever I'm like, I don't know what to do, I just sit down and I just think Joyce is sitting down at the end of the night and writing her diary entry, and it just flows out. You know, I just love the way that she can go from, you know, what she's watching on telly to a clue to the murder all in the same paragraph, and then start talking about her daughter, and then start talking about the shop.
Yes.
And then there's another clue. And that's how my brain works. I think that's how most people's brains work, is we're all over the place. Sometimes my fingers just won't leave the keyboard for, you know, 2 hours as I'm just writing a Joyce chapter, because it flows out worryingly easily.
You're a bit of Joyce then.
She's like my spirit animal is a 78-year-old woman called Joyce. Yeah.
Would you ever consider killing any of them off?
It's a really interesting question, that, and you know, that's a trope of crime fiction. Of course it is. You know, you kill off detectives, and I think writers usually regret it. My view is, I love writing them as a gang. I love the four of them coming from different perspectives. And I think it would be less fun to write if there wasn't the four of them, you know, if there weren't the four legs of the Thursday Murder Club horse. And so listen, never say never, because, you know, you've got to have some jeopardy in this world. But to me, the joy of the books is in those four and the fact that each of them has a different relationship with the other. And I think it would be less fun for me to write with three of them, and I think it would be less fun to read with three of them. I mean, listen, who knows? But I don't think that I would. I don't want people to constantly worry that that's going to happen. I'll kill off loads of people. You know, don't there'll be a body counts. Don't worry, from here to the end of time. It feels like the four of them are fairly sacrosanct to me.
Yeah, good, because you feel cheated if you lose a great character in a book. I always think.
Yeah, I think so.
Do you you know, when you're writing for the characters as well, do you picture them? Like, do you know what they look like?
Yeah, I do, which is funny, isn't it? Because, you know, the sort of parlour game of working out who's going to play who in the film that is really fun and everyone has an opinion on. You know, I'm the only one who doesn't really have an opinion because in my head they're sort of very real. I mean, I couldn't absolutely describe them to you. I'm not great with this. I don't often write descriptions of characters or what the sky is like or anything like that. But in my head, I very definitively have the four of them as sort of a shape. So I kind of I know who they are. And of course, the second that actors portray those roles, it'll be fascinating to see if that changes. But yeah, to me, you know, people say Julie Walters should be Joyce. I think, well, how can that be possible? Joyce is Joyce. That doesn't make any sense.
Julie Walters for Joyce is a great idea, actually.
There you are, you see. Yeah, Helen Mirren and Julie Walters.
Yeah. Yes! This is just getting better and better. can I ask as well, that the thing I love about you is you're dead funny as well as being really clever. There's some just brilliant humour in there. Like, one of the things that really stood out to me in the book was, humour-wise, loads of fab stuff in it, was the Moonpig advert being the knock on the door.
Oh, yeah.
And I literally acted that out as soon as I read it. I was like, I get that. Moonpig.com. Yeah. Got it. And I was like...
Isn't it funny? I love things like that in books where someone describes an action or something and you find yourself, you think, oh, yeah. Like, they'll describe sort of, you know, signing for the bill in a restaurant and you find yourself doing it yourself. The moon pig, I love things like that. You know, as I say, I don't set out to make the books funny, really. I'm certainly not writing jokes. It's not a comedy. But the way that these four live their lives and, you know, the accommodations they've made with the world around them, it just endlessly makes me laugh. And, you know, the way they react to things, you know, it's the famous thing of, you know, if you want something to happen in a story, send in a man with a gun. And I always think with the Thursday Murder Club, the joy of it is if I do send in a man with a gun, I instantly know how those four people will react. And they'll all react differently, but all of their reactions in their own way will sort of make me laugh. Because of the way they deal with things. So, yeah, humour, I love that the books make people laugh and around the world that's great as well because they love the British humour. But I think the key is I hope it never takes people out of the story because it's not like, oh, Joyce is a stand-up comedian who's done a one-liner. It's funny that Joyce has reacted and, you know, Joyce's arguments with her daughter they're funny. There's a... one in the second book where they have a huge row about which way the Venetian blinds should be slatted, whether they should go up or down. And it's a very real argument and conversation, but it also, but it is funny, you know? And so I hope that the humour in the book keeps us deeper into the story rather than takes us out of the story.
Yeah, because it's observational humour. It's like you say, it's not broom gag. It's that thing of, that's what we all do, don't we?
Exactly. And also everyone at home is now going...
Yeah.
They're doing the...
Yeah, because it works. I went in and said, after I was reading the book, and I went in to my partner and said, oh, there's this really funny line. Can you get what this is? And we were both howling at it. Anyway, back to murdering people. Can I ask, what do you think of the... Obviously, everyone's just been listening to the fantastic audio version of the book. Do you think about that when you're writing?
I listen to a lot of audiobooks. My eyesight is not all it might be, and it takes me a long time to read a book. And I love to walk around listening to audiobooks. Sometimes I think that's going to be really hard to read. And by that, I mean, I don't think it's very well written. because I sort of think it's the rhythm of it. If I've worked out that it's going to be hard to read, I kind of go, oh, that's because there's something slightly not right in it. You know, so you know, you knock out a few words here and there, and it's easy. So yeah, I think about it a lot because I love audiobooks, and I love how sort of cocooned in a world you get in an audiobook. You know, if you go for a lovely hour-long walk somewhere or if you're exercising, you are sort of absolutely transported, I think. I've always found that.
Yeah, and that's really interesting because I always say that at work with scripts. I always say to my team, like, read them out loud. Yeah. And if you can't read them very well, that means, you know, they need writing better.
Well that's it. Quite often at literary festivals, they get you to do a reading. And it's fascinating how often, as you're reading a chapter, you drop a word or two, or something. You just like, because you just think, oh, I shouldn't, that doesn't work. You know, you shouldn't have had that and in there. And it's sort of trying to root that out before it reaches the page.
Yeah. I also think, as someone who reads a lot physically and listens to audiobooks, I think it's worth doing both. I really do. Because it's like you hear different things to what you've read as well. I don't know if that makes sense, but I do that quite a lot too. I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, I think it's exactly right. It's weird, isn't it, that sensory thing, and also because some of us learn visually and some of us learn, you know, aurally, and I think that's the same with what we take in. You know, as I say, I remember audiobooks. I read books nonstop, and I can never remember a single thing about any of them. Right? I can always tell you books I loved. You know, I say, "Oh my god, I love that book!" And if you said to me, "What's it about?" I like, "Oh, I don't know," but I remember absolutely loving it. Whereas with audiobooks, I remember far more, and I love that sensation that you get with audiobooks. That sometimes you'll be like walking around the corner of somewhere on your estate, and you'll remember exactly what you heard. When you walked around that corner, there's this sort of memory. You walk around the corner and go, oh my god, that's where Victor was in his, you know, penthouse apartment talking to the guy Virgin Media. I remember walking around this corner as he was talking to them, and that I think you don't get with a book. I think it has much to commend it.
Did you ever think about narrating it then?
No, I mean, come on, firstly, it sort of feels like the book is broadly in a feminine voice and broadly in an older voice. And, you know, I can't do either of those things. But also my experience in telly and in everything is surround yourself by brilliant people who can do things better than you can. I know writers who do, and I absolutely get it. And, you know, like Mark Billingham, whose detective is slightly more his age and, you know, has his sensibility, and Mark is a comic and an actor. So, yeah. Of course he would read that audiobook. It makes sense and it sounds brilliant in his voice. But yeah, me sort of talking about Joyce going to the shops, I wouldn't buy that.
Is there, now you are three books in, is there anything that's kind of changed in your writing or the style or how you think based on the feedback you've had from people after the first two?
Yeah, I sort of have to try and ignore the feedback in a funny kind of way, and not because it's not welcome, because it is. And I if anyone sees me in the street, please stop me and chat to me about the books. I love it. People always say, "Oh, look, I'm sure you don't want to hear this," but then tell you something lovely about the book. I really do want to hear that. That's lovely to hear. But the feedback can be so different because everybody, you know, the lovely thing about this is they're a gang and everyone has their own favourite. So you get told a lot about who people's favourite characters are, and suddenly think, oh, hold on, I need to give a bigger part to all of these people. And, you know, if you took on every bit of feedback, you're sort of, the book would become a sprawling kind of Harry Potter-esque epic, you know, with everyone on their own quests. So I think very early on, I thought, well, look, you wrote the first two without any feedback, and, you know, you're proud of them both, and the characters sort of dragged you through. And so I have to just go, no, trust these characters, trust the process, trust the book that you want to write. But the feedback is, you know, I love it. I really, really love it. And I love people who, you know, loving the characters. But yeah, I can't get hung up on trying to give everybody everything that they want. I just have to go back to basics and write a great story and hope that people love it.
Yeah. So then, so that's interesting. So you try and block out the feedback. How did it feel when you went through the editing process? Because obviously somebody else then coming in and saying, ah, get rid of this.
Yeah.
Add this. What was that like?
Well, for the first book, it was sort of great because I'd never written a book before, and I hadn't, you know, I'd given up on the Thursday Murder Club a few times, because anyone who's listening to this who's ever written knows you kind of look at your computer and you read back what you wrote yesterday and you just go, well, this is terrible. I mean, no one's ever going to read this. But yeah, so all I'd done is read. I hadn't written. So actually the first editing process was fascinating because they said, you know, you can chop this out and it still holds together. I made it, you know, I overwrote and there's too much stuff in there. So that was fascinating. And honestly, the editing process for the other two, it's a joy because you write a book to the absolute best of your ability, you know, and you love it and you're proud of it and all that stuff. And then you get unbelievably talented people who read the book, who are enjoying the book, but then kind of say, oh, I tell you what, if this section moved here, then wouldn't that be great? Or I'm not quite, do I believe this character would do this? I'm not absolutely sure I do. So they just give you these notes and you can go back and you just make your book so much better before anyone has read it. You know, and I always think when people sort of worry when they're writing a book, because they read other people's books and just go, well, this is so polished, it's so great, my book's never going to be that. And, you know, you should read people's first drafts because most of the stuff is there, but it's sort of not quite in the right order. And there's just little bits that change. And so what you're reading is what the writer has done, plus a sort of a group of incredibly talented people who love books. Have said, oh, I'm not sure about this bit, I'm not sure about that bit. So you get the opportunity to sort of erase a mistake before anyone reads it. I absolutely love the editing process. It's like, it saves your life. Yeah.
But do you not have, did you, were there not like some bits where you were asked to cut them out and you're like, oh, but I really.
No, it's never happened. No. It's never happened.
Good.
It's like, well, I'm quite a self editor anyway. You know, so if I'm writing something and I'm like, that's the nice thing with editing is you think, oh, the editor will say, what has happened in the scene that's moved the story along? And if it's nothing, then you think, okay, well, listen, I'm going to have to lose this scene anyway, so I'm going to stop writing it. You know, something has got to move the story along in each scene. And there's the other side of editing, which is you get these amazing people, the proof editors, the copy editors, who will go through the whole text and just say, so, you know, Joyce and Elizabeth are on this train from Polegate up to London, and it's like the 9:43. I go, yeah. Because just so you know, that there actually isn't a trolley service on that train. So, and you've written that there is. And sometimes I just leave it. I think, honestly, I'm going to say there is a trolley service. And, you know, just little references. I go, you know, you've mentioned this Liverpool bought a player and Ron is listening. Well, they bought that player 20 years ago. And you're like, oh, no, it's a made-up name. Don't worry, that's okay. But occasionally they'll say things and you just go, oh, my God, you're absolutely right. That's so good. And you just change tiny little factual things. The biggest trouble I've ever got in on the Thursday Murder Club series, the only thing I've really been in trouble for was in the very first book in Thursday Murder Club, Ian Ventham, who's the property developer, visits the Waitrose in Tunbridge Wells. And of course I didn't check if Waitrose has got a Tunbridge Wells if Tunbridge Wells has got a Waitrose, because of course it does. It's Tunbridge Wells. But it doesn't. And everyone in Tunbridge Wells is furious because they were having a hard time anyway with not having a Waitrose. They were cross enough about that. And suddenly I'm right and they did have one. So that's the thing that the copy editors usually save you from. But brilliantly in that circumstance, even the copy editor didn't bother looking it up because, I mean, of course Tunbridge Wells would have a Waitrose, right?
Yeah. Hopefully they're now going to get one though based on that. You know, that you've given them lots of publicity.
I don't think they do. Funny enough, I put it right in this book. I don't know if people spotted. There's a bit where Joyce is talking about Tunbridge Wells. And she said, I think I read somewhere that there's a Waitrose, but there isn't.
Brilliant.
That's a little Easter egg.
That's clever.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's clever. What about the names of the books? How was that decided?
Well, the Thursday Murder Club was easy because I just, you know, funny enough, at my mum's retirement community, they had like a kind of bulletin board and it's got like, you know, Tuesday Knit and Natter, Wednesday French Conversation. And I just, as soon as I had Thursday Murder Club, that was done. Yeah, it's quite a big process, funnily enough, and everyone has opinions. So this book was either going to be called The Bullet That Missed or The Third Bullet. So we were sort of thinking of names for it, and my partner Ingrid and I were talking. We came up with all these bullet titles, and those were the two favourites. And I really liked the third bullet, and other people disagreed. So I said, can you ask the sales team what their opinion is? Because the sales team are the great heroes of the book trade, and you know they sell by word of mouth. They're incredible, and also they really, really understand their business. They understand the bookshops. You know, they understand all the big chains. So I said, say to the sales team, give them those two titles and tell them, you know, what they come back with. And I think there was 12 of them came back, and 10 of them came back the bullet that missed, and only two of them the third bullet. Mm-hmm. So I said, okay, we're going with the bullet that missed. And they're right. As soon as it's on the cover, you just go, oh, that's a really good title. You know,
yeah.
And I like my titles to have, certainly The Man Who Died Twice and The Bullet That Missed, they sort of ask a question. You know, you sort of go, oh, I wonder, that's interesting. And, you know, both, certainly with those two titles, the answer is not the answer that you expect. And it sort of gets revealed very late on why they're called that.
Yeah, yeah. And the thing I've enjoyed as well is all your posts on social media of all the different front covers around the world and all the translations of it. And what's that been like, seeing it being translated? And have there been any kind of, you know, differences where you've gone, God, I just never would have thought that that's what they would have to do in Germany or whatever?
Yeah, I love it. Well, funnily enough, talking about audiobooks, I was over in Germany a couple of weeks ago to do a book event. We did like a tour because they love it in Germany. They love, which is amazing. It's like, you know, it's a big hit. And I did this event on a boat in Hamburg, so we did this lovely thing and people came along. But one of the people on the event was my German audiobook reader, Johann, who's like a big soap star in Germany.
Yeah,
he plays like a doctor on a big soap, and he did a reading of it, and he did a reading. There's a scene in The Man Who Died Twice where Ron is furious because there'd been a dead body in Elizabeth's flat and she hadn't invited him over to see it. So he gets angry. And I was sitting there, and Johann, the German audiobook guy, is being Ron in this scene and screaming, just furious, sort of walking up and down the aisle and yelling at Elizabeth about not being allowed to see this body. And, you know, I don't speak German, but I was like getting every word of it. It was absolutely amazing. So hearing the audiobook versions of the foreign ones is very fun. And we've just got the Chinese one of the second book through. And my daughter speaks Chinese, so she goes through it and lets me know what's been kept in and what's been left out and all that kind of stuff.
So I
find it fascinating. And I find it fascinating that all around the world, you know, Brazil and China and all over, they love this sort of English or very British sort of murder mystery thing and the humour of it. And I find it extraordinary to go speak at foreign festivals and people ask questions about Joyce. You think that seems so odd to me.
Yeah, yeah. But you're right, they do love it. And that's what's amazing. And also, inevitably, it's going to be on our screens at some point. Like, how do you feel about that? You've worked in telly a long, long time. So are you going to be really involved in it? Are you going to step back? How are you doing it?
I'm going to be entirely uninvolved.
Are you?
Yeah, of course, because again, you know, I've got a job, which is to write the fourth book, you know, and that's the thing I love, and I feel like that's the thing I'm best at. And Amblin Entertainment, which is Steven Spielberg's company, is working on the film.
And what a name drop. Yeah, I love that. Well, yeah, listen, just Steven Spielberg.
Listen, Steve, I call him. Big Steve. And you have to leave them to it, because he knows what he's doing. And I know that if I were to get involved, that 6 months of my life sort of, and you wouldn't get the things you wanted anyway. And suddenly you're taken out of writing book four. So book four, you'd all have to wait 2 years for instead of 1 year. And I'd rather write a book a year at the moment, because that's, I'm a TV guy. And I just think if you've created something that people are enjoying, then keep creating it. You know, keep doing it, you know, give them one a year for as long as you can, because that feels like the least I can do, if I'm honest.
Yeah.
And I know that as soon as you start getting involved in screenplays and stuff like that, your time is not your own. And suddenly people are waiting 3 years for the Thursday Murder Club. And I don't think that's right. I don't want to wait 3 years for Thursday Murder Club. And so I'm not going to make readers wait 3 years either.
Yeah. How do you work out your time then? Like, because obviously, you know, you're filming a lot, and I know you're not going to be doing Pointless anymore, but you're still doing House and Games and stuff. Do you, you know, take me through like a typical day for you, because you say you're writing like 1,000 words a day.
Yeah.
Do you do it at a certain time of day? Have you got a set up and then you're film? How does it work?
Well, that's you know, giving up Pointless, I had to really, something I had to give. That's sort of 3 months of my year that's been, you know, opened up. And if I'm filming, I'm filming. That's it. I don't have another head to do that. So if I'm doing House of Games, like today, funnily enough, I'm heading up to Glasgow. Although, as I say, hottest day of the year, and I'm not sure the trains are going to be working. And so if I'm doing that, we'll shoot for a week, and that's it. I only do that. I don't then go home and write 1,000 words. I can't. But when I know I'm writing, so for the next book, I'm doing thinking at the moment, but it's probably the start of August I'll actually start writing. And then it's, you know, the first couple of months you're writing maybe 3-4 days a week, you do that 1,000 words, and then maybe you up it a little bit, and then by sort of January, when my deadline is looming, I'll be, you know, in 7 days a week, you know, writing 2,000 words a day, because I'm absolutely panicking, like exactly like when you did homework when you're at school. But yeah, it's If I'm filming, I'm filming. I can't do two things at once. It's not how my brain works. And if I'm writing, yeah, I go upstairs, sit down in front of the computer, bare wall in front of me, and I know I'm going to write for 2 hours, phone off, social media off, all of that kind of stuff. Window open so I can hear a bit of noise from outside. I like something to, you know, keep me occupied. But I'm pretty good at then just writing for 2 hours. And, you know, not stopping, and not sort of going back and kind of rewriting and changing it all. So I'm quite disciplined in that way. And I try in that 1,000 words, because I'm quite a goal-oriented human being. And as a writer, you have to work out who you are psychologically, I think. And so I try and write a whole chapter. That's the idea. And that's why my chapters are, you know, short and about 1,000 words long, because I like to write them in one go. So pretty much any chapter you read there, I started... And I finished on the same day. And of course you go back you know, you edit and change them. But the actual bare bones of it, you know, pretty much every chapter is 1 day's work, which feels quite nice.
Yeah. And does it, because you know, when the first book came out, it became a bestseller, you know, pretty quickly, and it did amazingly well, broke loads of records and sales and things. Did that make you feel more nervous about, like, the second book coming out? I know you'd already written it, hadn't you? But did you feel... more nervous and now writing and having written the third and now writing the fourth, does it intimidate you at all, or are you just like
it's
can block it out?
It's a really good question. I do think about it. I think because I've had a whole career in telly, and I've been, you know, I've had hits and I've had flops, and I've had shows that start slow and get big, and I've had shows that start big and then, you know, disappear. I think my brain, this is not new to me, if you know what I mean, and I think that I was so thrilled by the success of the first book and the second book. And because in life, you know, I have had things that I was proud of that didn't do well, I sort of just decide to ride the wave. You know, you have to, of course you could mess it up. Of course you could. But you have to trust yourself and trust the process. And so long as I'm sitting down writing and entertaining myself and those characters entertaining me, and I know I've got a good story, then... you do sort of, you have to shut off that other voice that says, yeah, but this might be a disaster, because you kind of think, but it's this, you know, it's, these are characters you love, it's a story you're proud of, you know, if one day people fall out of love with it, so be it, but for as long as it's entertaining people, then you just keep doing it, and, you know, you keep at it, and you try and, you know, obviously you try and change it up, and you try, you know, you try and get to try and be a better writer and all of that kind of stuff. But yeah, I'm pretty good with the pressure of it. I think, you know, pressure is a privilege, isn't it? And I like sitting there writing a Joyce chapter and being able to say to Joyce, just so you know, lots of people are going to read this. You know, that's good. Yeah. So if I write something that I think, oh, that's nice, or that's, you know, that's made me laugh, or that's made me cry, or that's a nice little twist, I sort of know that lots of people are going to experience that, and that gives you a sort of an inner strength.
Are the characters going to age at all? Or are you going to keep them the same age as they go?
Well, the first three books sort of all start, they all pretty much start the day the previous one ends. So in the first three books, we've only been through about 6 months, really. And the next book, we sort of start at Christmas. So I reckon you could knock out sort of 10 or 12 books and they would have only aged 3 years.
Is a lot of murders in 3 years.
No, well, that's the bigger issue is, you know, all the books I try and make sure, I don't want to write a series where, oh, another body has just turned up. I like having stories where the things they did in the previous book naturally mean that the events of the next book are going to happen. So they're getting themselves in this trouble. It's not like, you know, Murder, She Wrote or something. And whether we can do that 12 times, we'll find out. But I think that they've got a good few years left in them yet.
Yeah. Yeah. So 12, is that the kind of...
Oh, I don't know. I mean, we'll see. You don't know. As soon as I say 12, the publishers go, 12, is it? I'm doing the first four, then I'm going to start writing another series, but I would be coming straight back to Thursday Murder Club. Ah. So we're definitely going to have six. And if people still keep, you know, reading them, then I shall keep writing them.
Yeah. So what are you, sorry to, you know, the journalists in me now, is that what other series? What are you allowed to tell us anything about that?
Well, look, it's only at a nascent stage at the moment. I'm just thinking of, I was thinking when I go to these foreign, you know, literary festivals and things, it's really lovely and they're beautiful places. But I'm quite a reluctant traveller. You know, a bit of me would sort of rather stay at home, if I'm honest, and, you know, watch Holmes Under the Hammer or watch The Snooker. And so, you know, just in my head, I've got the very beginning thoughts of a proper kind of international caper, like a proper round the world, you know, in all the sort of most glamorous locations, but with a detective who doesn't really want to be there, you know, who would rather be at home sort of, you know, waiting to do his pub quiz. And so that sort of, you know, reluctant global traveller detective, I thought might be a fun world.
Yeah. Oh, God, this is really exciting. Richard, I could talk to you about this forever, but we should let people get on with their day. So, Richard, thank you very much. Lovely chatting to you.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Stefan. Thank you for chatting, and thank you to everyone for listening as well. I hope you loved it.
We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of The Bullet That Missed, a Thursday Murder Club mystery by Richard Osman, read for you by Fiona Shaw. This programme was directed by Cameron Potts. Post-production by Ross Berman. Text copyright 2022 by Richard Osman. Production copyright 2022 Penguin Audio. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this programme.